I think we're ready to get started. If everybody could make their way. Well, good morning, everyone, and good Friday. We have a lot to get through today, so we're going to go ahead and jump right in. We do have a quorum, so I'd like to see if I can get a motion to adopt the minutes. And a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great. All right. Thank you all for coming on spring break week. I have just a couple of announcements from my end. First, I did meet with Cheryl Moore, who was here in January, as you'll recall, and is the Chief Operating Officer of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And I have invited her to the remaining open slot on the board, the appointed advisory slot. She didn't say yes, but she didn't say no. And my sense was that she could be convinced. And so I'm very glad to say both Jim Bennett and John Lenihan, and also John Wood, who I don't see, I think you all called her.
Yeah, we're working on it.
So I'd like to invite anybody else that knows Cheryl, Randy, I think you're her next door neighbor, anybody else who feels moved to make a phone call. I think we sent some flowers or a plant, so we're putting the full court press on Cheryl to say yes. And if anybody can help in that regard, let her know what a friendly crowd we are and how much fun this group is. I think she'd make a great addition. The second item I just wanted to report on was a meeting that I had with the Fairfax County Economic Development Authority Chair and President, and the Prince William County Economic Development Council Chair. Sean Kelly and I made the pilgrimage to Fairfax, and we had reached out to both groups just with the idea of having a bit of a regional dialogue, find out what's on their agenda, what's on our agenda, see if we might be able to coordinate on things. And I thought it was a very interesting meeting. I think each three of these groups is very different. The Fairfax County is actually an authority. They issue bonds. Very different organization from ours, quite separate from the government, although they do get their funding from the government. One thing that that the president there, Jerry Gordon, asked me to pass along was his thanks for educating all of his workforce children. The children of his workforce. They only spend about 53 cents, or 53% their budget, on education. And we were talking about transportation and workforce housing, and he said, "Well, you guys are housing all of our, educating all of our workers' kids." And I said, "Well, at least we're doing a good job, right?" Prince William, probably a little bit more like us. They have a council, and it's smaller. They focus on sort of projects. They hire consultants to work on things and kind of get things done. So it's a little bit similar, more similar to ours than Fairfax, in that they kind of serve as an incubator. One of the things that they were most surprised about our group is how big we are and that we still manage to accomplish things. And I assured them that we did manage to accomplish things. Sean, do you want to add anything in terms of your impressions of the meeting?
That Fairfax is kind of a separate entity, Fairfax group, and they really focus on their main mission is job creation. So they measure their success in number of jobs created per year, if that was accurate, in March. I echo Mark's comments. They're a little smaller than us, and especially Fairfax, they're obviously much more established in their authority rather than the mission we have.
Yeah, they're Fairfax, big metric, single focus, job creation. When I talked about our looking at transportation and other issues, they said, well, they got other departments doing that.
Speaking of job creation, for those who wonder how Loudoun's doing, this isn't too obscene, I call it the Loudoun finger. This is how we're doing with job creation over the last 6 years in percentage growth, which you would expect. And actually, our absolute numbers are just about the same as Fairfax's, believe it or not. So we create just about as many jobs. So that's 44% for Loudoun, there's Fairfax, Arlington. Arlington's definitely got a problem with RAC. When you see what they're already doing, coming up, going to loosen that around. So Loudoun does not have a jobs problem.
Who's on the
floor? That's Prince, Prince William, Loudoun, Fairfax, Arlington.
Thank you.
There you go.
We didn't bring that chart. okay, a couple other items. I have the rare opportunity this morning to confirm a rumor on the personal end of things. Some of you may have heard that I was taking a hard look at running for Board of Supervisors. And for a variety of reasons, as with any tough decision, there wasn't a single factor. I've decided not to pursue that nomination and election. Probably the paramount reason is that I've had kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity presented to me to work for a two-state solution to peace in the Middle East. And I think some of you may know I was actually born and raised in Jerusalem. My father and my sister have dedicated their careers to working for peace in the Middle East. So I sort of feel like I'm going into the family business a little bit. And I haven't ruled out anything for the long-term future. In fact, I kind of was thinking about this, and I thought, well, have an opportunity to deal with the skirmishes over there. That might be good training for taking on land use wars here in Loudoun. So we'll see. I'll keep you posted on that. But meantime, I've remained very dedicated, of course, to this group and to my service on the housing board. So I'll stay around in those ways. The next thing I want to call your attention to is a blue sheet at your desk. This is a flyer on preparing for the pandemic. And Robin, do you want to say a word about these seminars?
Yeah, thank you. We had Stephen Hood here 2 months ago and talked about pandemic flu. We put together seminars April 11th, and we have the information in front of you. I would love to challenge the commission to have two people per commission show up at a seminar. Our attendance is relatively low. It's sort of like writing the will. We all should do it, but no one actually wants to actually put the act. So we would love to have you publicize this for us. Thank you.
Okay. And finally, at your desks is also a packet of bios. This is an opportunity for us to look at our bios, make sure they're up to date. I think there are a few missing. I won't single them out, but if you look through here and your bio's not in there, please get it to Deborah. And I think that's it. We're going to move a few things around because we do have some very special guests this morning. So Larry's going to give us his report later. And we'll also look at committee updates and the resolution a little later in the agenda. And we will get right to our legislative update. We're delighted to have some honorees with us here this morning. Memory Porter, whose reputation and long work for the county is legend. And I understand you're in some of your final days. We're delighted that you could join us here this morning.
Message from space.
Yeah. The Honorable Russell Potts is also here from the 27th Senate District, and the Honorable Joe May. And Memory, I think we're going to start with you. We've asked you to come and present us with a little bit of an update of what happened down there this year.
Tom Russ, I'm sorry. Okay. Half of your program say Russ Potts. That was a goof. Russ Potts to Tom Russ.
Tom Russ, I'm very sorry. I actually met him 2 minutes ago. My apologies. So Memory, we're going to start with you.
All right. Do you want me to get
it? There's a mic up here if you want, or we can bring it to you, whatever you would like.
It probably doesn't matter. Yeah, bring it to me. I'm Memory Porter. I am getting ready to retire. I've done this job working as a lobbyist for Loudoun County since 1980, and I'm tired. And so I am getting ready to retire, so I think Larry asked me to come to tell you like it, how it works. So I'm going to be very kind to Joe Ray and Tom Russ, who are two of my favorite delegates, and we need to send them back to Richmond. Larry said that maybe I should just do some fundamentals about how the system works. Number one, there are a lot of rules to how the General Assembly works. In my experience in 28 years, if you want to get something done, you can get something done. It may take a couple of years, but you can do it. It takes leadership. And that's actually what we ended up having. This veto override session and this past session is the Speaker of the House finally said, we've got to get a transportation bill through. And it was really through his leadership, with a lot of backup from Northern Virginia and particularly Hampton Roads legislators who also knew they needed to solve a problem. But it took leadership to do it, because without it, we were in where we had been for the last 2.5 years of making no decision. We have 100 delegates in the state and 40 senators. We, of course, have 5 delegates. 2 of them are here. We have 2 senators, Mark Herring and Russ Potts, and Russ is not running again. So that will be an open seat where we only need to think long and hard who we replace him with. What I would like to say to the business community is, since you are the people who probably give contributions to people running for office, you need to look long and hard at any candidate running for office who takes a no tax pledge, because that's what got us in the bind that we were in for the last 3 or 4 years. There is a body of House members who took no tax pledges from all over the state, not just some from Northern Virginia, but not only from Northern Virginia. And when they take a no tax pledge and they feel they are bound to never vote for a tax no matter what, that is what puts the General Assembly in a bind. Because just like transportation, I don't think there was a person who disagreed that we need more money. We need money from someplace, and it had to be either a new tax or fee. But if you have a body, 20, let's say 25 members out of 100, in this case, most of them Republicans, going into a caucus where we're not allowed in, and they have these private discussions, and they're saying, we're not voting for a tax, that's what got us in a bind. So what ended up happening this year is we ended up having to bypass some of the committees and send it to another committee in order to get the bills even out onto the floor. General Assembly works much like Congress. A bill is introduced in either the House or Senate. It then has to get out of a committee. Then it has to go to the floor, and then it has to go to the other body. And I'm going to hand out, I didn't hand this out yet, I didn't probably make enough, but it's just a list of who is on the various committees in both houses. Seniority counts a lot. Why we're so happy to have Joe May, who is moving up. It's going to be a loss for us because Vince Callahan is retiring. He is in Northern Virginia. We will not have a Northern Virginia as chairman of appropriations. It may be a bunch of years before that happens again. That's a downside, but those things occur. There has been some scuttlebutt about who will replace Vince. I have a clue. The Speaker gets to decide. So you as business leaders, you need to know who the Speaker is, and you need to develop a relationship with him, just for a variety of reasons. But he is, it has been said, he's one of the most powerful people in the state of Virginia because of the power he has in the House and the power of committee and assignments and chairmanships. Northern Virginia, we've got, you know, some people think that with the number of legislators we have in Northern Virginia, why can't we get anything done? Well, two reasons. One is seniority, and you've got to be on the right committee in order to get the bill out of committee. But two is Northern Virginia delegation's divided on tax issues, on a bunch of issues. Well, I've been here since 1980. That hasn't always been the case. It used to be that we would have Northern Virginia delegation meetings, we'd come up with a game plan, and everybody, some more reluctantly than others, would sign on to it, and we'd try to get something accomplished. That has not been the case in recent years. We're a divided delegation. We have people who have sharp feelings against taxes, and then we have other people who don't love taxes, but at least understand that if government's going to function, you've got to have money to do it in. My observation over the years is the most important thing that we can do, and whoever we send to Richmond, is what they do when they get there. And I guess I've got two prime examples right here. Our delegation, we want our senators and delegates to develop relationships with other delegates and senators across the state, because it's that teaming that gets stuff done. Nobody, you've got to keep your promises, you've got to keep your word, you've got to be informed on why you're doing stuff, and these are really important attributes. They ought to be important attributes for everywhere in life, but they're really important attributes for how stuff gets done in the General Assembly. We have had, and I don't even need to name anyone, we have had delegates and senators who are isolationists, they have no friends, whatever. Well, they're going to have a problem getting stuff done, because it's just like we were joking about seatmates and all that. It's who you sit next to, who you go out to dinner with, who you sit next to in committee meetings, that you develop these relationships, and that's how you get the votes. One of the reasons that I have enjoyed my job over all these many years is we've got a great General Assembly. I'm not going to say every particular person is my favorite person, but I tell you what you do have. You've got good people who got elected from back home who want to do the right thing. Sometimes it isn't an issue in their area, but if you can go to them and explain why it's an issue in another area of the state, and if they're decent people and don't have a other hidden agenda, they'll understand it. It is one of the reasons that I have enjoyed my job so much, is because there's a bunch of good elected officials down there who, although they work themselves to death in that very short session, they do want to do the right thing, and they don't want to. One of the easiest things for me to do is when we get a bill and it's going to cost us a lot of money, I can just go to them and say, I don't know what it's going to cost your locality, but it's going to cost us $6 million to implement this. And that's usually enough to put up a flag that they'll at least go find out what that's going to do to their locality. Because I don't think anybody wants to go home and find out that they've done something really bad. A couple weeks ago, we had a Virginia Association of Counties meeting with legislators, and Tom was there. And it was a bunch of local elected officials meeting with state legislators to just talk over, all right, we've got through this session, hopefully we'll get transportation solved. What do we need to do next? How do we need to do it? And one of the things that came up at that meeting was the Dillon Rule, which, if you don't know what the Dillon Rule is, it's a rule that says, and we're a Dillon Rule state, the rule says local governments can't do anything unless they get explicit permission to do it in state law. That is different from a home rule state. Maryland is a home rule state. In a home rule state, localities can do whatever they want unless the General Assembly tells them specifically they can't do that. So that's the difference. My favorite story when I first started in Richmond a long time ago was Arlington had to come down. It took them 3 years to get this bill passed. They wanted permission to put deadbolt locks on apartment doors. And it took them a couple of years to get that passed. I mean, it seems ridiculous now. We have, just last year or the year before, Arlington wanted permission to spend their own county money to help employees with workforce housing. They had to give permission from the General Assembly. There are myriad issues that would seem like no-brainers, but because of the Dillon Rule, we can't get it fixed. So one of the discussions was at this meeting was maybe we should take another look at the Dillon Rule, and maybe even the business community could help us look at the Dillon Rule, because it defies logic as to why we have to go down there and get these picayune little things fixed when the General Assembly wanted to be dealing with the big policy issues. And one of the issues, well, why don't we get the Dillon Rule fixed? Because taxes is one of them. As you know, counties do not have the same taxing authorities as towns and cities. My favorite example is the meals tax. Every town in Loudoun can have a meals tax, and most of them do. Counties are not allowed to. If we could have the same meals tax that Leesburg has, we could generate $12 million a year. Certainly help our school construction, certainly help roads, certainly help whatever else we need, not on the property tax, but we're not allowed to do it. But when a bill is introduced in the General Assembly to give us the meals tax, and there practically every year there is one introduced, who shows up but the taxes that we're not allowed to have that cities and towns can have are the cigarette tax, the lodging tax, the meals tax, the admissions tax, and there may be one other. Bills get introduced, that's when you see all the lobbyists. The only time the lobbyists from those industries come to county, cities, and towns is when we're in the House Finance, is when those bills are up to say why they oppose them. And why do they oppose them? Because it's a lot easier to kill it in Richmond than to have to go to every county in the state and fight the size of a meals tax or a cigarette tax. Northern Virginia is rich. There's just no two ways about it. And it is resented in Richmond. And they say to us, we would love to have your problems. And then they tell us about how their area has just lost 500 jobs. And what can you say? You can't top that. You can't say, well, that's tough. That is a real problem. So the fact that we're rich and the fact that we are resented, we have to recognize that and figure out how to deal with that. And now I'm going to jump topics now. I'm going to talk about power lines. Joe Bay here. We're going to talk about power lines. This is a big issue. The delivery of electricity should be important to the business community. It should be important to every citizen. And we are going to get crisscrossed with power lines in this county in the near future. And I think there's a heck of a good argument that we need to be looking seriously at undergrounding them. And I think we're making progress in that area. Whether we make it in time to solve some of Loudoun's problems, I don't know. We also need to look at whether Dominion Power and others are doing enough on peak demand. Are we doing everything we can to knock down that peak demand, to maybe cut out some of this? Because most of the power lines we need are for peak demand. They're not for the average whatever. So we need to take a serious look at that, and you should care. Because we just passed this, whatever they're calling it, re-regulation bill, and everyone is fearful that we're going to see a big hike in electric rates coming up. And that's going to affect not only you and your home, but you and your businesses, and especially if you use a lot of power. So those are issues that you all need to be tuned into. Now I'm going to change subjects again. I want to do a little tax talk. We did get... thanks to these two people and a lot of other people in the General Assembly, we finally did get a transportation bill. One of the things that local governments in Northern Virginia are going to be able to do is put a surtax on all commercial industrial lands. All multifamily housing has been excluded from the bill, so it's just commercial industrial land. The way the bill finally passed is Loudoun County and all other jurisdictions in Northern Virginia, but let's just talk about Loudoun County. We can put on up to a 25 cent per $100 value surtax. We've been given total flexibility. What has got to happen in the next coming months is we need to have a serious dialogue of how much surtax can we live with and what are we going to do with it when we get it. Now, one thing is for certain, every dime we raise in Loudoun County is going to stay in Loudoun County, so that's a good part. But we need to figure out what's the proper level of a surtax to help pay for transportation. The other thing that the bill does is it gives the Northern Virginia Authority, Transportation Authority, which has existed since, I think, 2001, the right to put on a slew of taxes. There are, you've probably seen them in the paper, I don't even know if I can list them all, but there are taxes on lodging, there's taxes on rental cars, there's the grantor's tax, which is a tax you pay when you sell your property. You pay, you're going to pay a 40 cents on $100 value of the sale of that property, and it will go to transportation. There's sales tax on auto repairs or auto parts, and I know I'm leaving one out. But anyway, there's a slew of taxes. How this bill will work is the Northern Virginia Authority, which has existed for a bunch of years and has had no money to spend, so though they've been working on plans, they haven't been working on actually how to execute any of this, but now they're going to have the money. They are going to be able to put these taxes on, and they are going to be able to do it if at least six out of the nine localities in Northern Virginia agree they want to do it. And of those six, they have to represent at least two-thirds of the population in the district. That was language that was put into the authority law in, I think the second year it was in effect, in 2002, to kind of make sure there was a balance of, that Fairfax couldn't just take all our money. It was put in there to have a balance of where the region would act as a region and couldn't, not one locality could override and say only my project can be done with this money. We think that's a fairly comfortable way to do it. And in addition, in the language in the bill, it says that every dime raised in each locality will go back to that locality. How that will work out, we'll sort out as we figure out which projects can move first before others. So there may be years when not all of Loudoun's money comes back that year, but the next year when a Loudoun project gets done, there'll be a tab kept that makes sure we get to keep our money. The region's going to raise about $325 million. Of that, we're making a guess, $35 million of that is ours. So I am telling our staff, we're going to get $35 million a year in some fashion to help our transportation needs. And in addition, we're going to get to put on this surtax, which will never leave the county, and we'll spend that also. When you add up both what the region can raise and what the locality can raise in the surtax, it gets us well above the $400 million we were striving for. There's an impact fee law in the bill, typically me, since I've only worked on it for 20 years, that will let us take a fresh look at doing transportation impact fees in Loudoun County for anyone that doesn't go through the proper system. So we will be looking at developing that law. Our board has been asking for it probably the whole time I've been in the General Assembly. And we had a law on the books, but it was always unworkable. And I think Joe tried several years to get it cleaned up to make it work right. Well, because it was this big package this year and this omnibus bill, the governor put language in there and gave us impact fees, and it's now in the bill and it didn't get stripped out. So we have, locally, we've got the surtax on commercial and industrial, we've got the use of impact fees to pay for transportation, and we do have the opportunity to put on a $10 annual registration fee. Doesn't generate a lot of money, but I guess every half million counts when you're counting. there were two issues in the bill that we went on with the governor, and one is, as much as everybody dislikes VDOT and has problems with VDOT, what the bill, as it passed the General Assembly, was going to make us take over planning and construction of all secondary roads. And that was a real problem for Loudoun County, but it was also a real problem for even Fairfax County, who already does a lot of road building. So what the governor ended up doing was make that local option. If and when we think we're capable of taking over a project and running it ourselves, we're going to have permission with this law to do it. But in the case where we just can't get the, our manpower going, we can continue to work with VDOT. There is another issue that dealing with road maintenance. There is this mindset in Richmond that we are one of only two or three states in the whole country that still has state doing secondary roads. Well, there are some people in Richmond that thinks it will solve a lot of their problems if we can stop that practice and give that responsibility back to counties. Well, we're adamantly opposed to that. And the irony is that the amount of money that would be saved should this ever come to pass will be so minuscule, it will not solve any of the state's problems. And what it will create in Loudoun is we could conceivably have subdivision streets that we have to maintain, whereas some of the subdivision streets the state still will maintain. So you need snow removed somewhere? I don't know who you're going to call. So that's a year away problem, but it is something that we need to be mindful of, that may be still something that some people think ought to be a county responsibility and no longer a state responsibility. I got two more issues. This past year, there was a bill introduced, a tax bill. Now, I want to talk about how the House of Delegates has been working in recent years, because it is abysmal. What they do now is they put all bills in subcommittee. And I don't deny that they don't work hard down there. They have subcommittee meetings starting many times at 6:30 in the morning, subcommittee. So you go to your subcommittee meeting at 6:30 in the morning, and there is quorum, and they kill the bill. Let's see. Bill dies in subcommittee, never shows up again. It is over and done with, and they do not have to record the vote. So if I want to go back the next day and find out, well, who should I want this bill to be alive. Who should I work on? I can't go to the clerk of committee and say, who were the votes? That is wrong. It's only been in effect 2 years, but it is outrageous that exists. We had, Mark Herrick had carried a bunch of bills for Loudoun County and Leesburg, and in a county citizen town subcommittee meeting at 7:30 in the morning, they killed all of his bills. And no recorded vote, and one of them was a bill that Scott York had asked for. We had that conflict between the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors when we were doing those CPAM amendments, and the board wasn't ready to act, and the 90 days ended, so we had to send it to the Planning Commission to get it recertified so we could look at it some more. Well, we had a bill in, Mark Herring carried it for us, that was going to give us a little more flexibility in that for complicated land use decisions, and they killed it. And one of the delegates said in the committee, I'm standing up there with Mark Herring, and she said, I don't know why you have a problem with these timelines. We deal with 3,500 bills in 45 days, and we have no problem. It took all of my willpower not to say, excuse me, the reason that you don't have any problem is you've totally locked the public out of the process. You make mistakes. Every year I come back here, and you're fixing mistakes you made from the year before. I mean, is this the General Assembly that
unwittingly undid the blue laws and had to have a special session. I mean, you are not dealing with these bills appropriately. You are just passing them and then coming back the next year and fixing them again. But I didn't say any of that. One thing that the General Assembly can do, and it has pluses and minuses, but it does mean they can get stuff done, is they meet in private. Call caucus meetings. They hash their stuff out behind closed doors. I should only wish that local governments could have that same freedom to go into a back room and say, all right, let's duke it out back here and figure out what we're going to do. We get none of that. We have, anything we do has to be an open session. We can have no private conversations. We can't have a private retreat where we go and talk about stuff. We can't do any of that. Virginia can do it. And I do say, although the media does get locked out of that, it does mean they can talk it out and say what they think and before they have to come out and make a decision. I will give the governor credit. When he came up after the transportation bill passed, what he did, and he got away with it, so it worked, is he met with the mayors and chairs of each region of the state in private so they could have a frank discussion of why they liked the things in the bill, why they didn't like things in the bill, blah, blah, blah. All got done. What he did after that meeting was he went out with the local elected officials and had a press conference and talked about what they talked about. But he didn't have to reveal every little comment made by board members worried about this or that or whatever. There is some merit to be able to have private discussions on difficult issues. And I do have to give the speaker credit, as I started out this morning. I would not have bet this would have happened, but he did show the leadership he needed to show to get this bill passed. It was amazing, and it took 2.5 years, but it was good they did it. My solution, one of them, which these gentlemen have heard before, is I think we need to work to televise all General Assembly meetings. I think they need to be televised. I think subcommittee meetings need to be televised. I think that if you could see how some of the business is conducted down there, you would have a different attitude about who you would elect to office. It can be pretty bad. And the reason that this subcommittee thing is so bad is the new rule in the House is if you go to subcommittee and you speak in subcommittee, you're not allowed to talk in full committee. Now, not all committees run that way, but most of the committees do run that way. So if you've gone to subcommittee, and on this tax bill I was going to talk about, had to deal with giving nanotechnology a big, big tax break. It was going to cost us a lot of, Loudoun County a lot of money, it was going to cost Fairfax a lot of money. It came up as a substitute bill, brand new bill, we had never seen it printed, in a subcommittee. We jumped to our feet, said 2 or 3 words with like, I guess I'll have to check back home to see if this is bad. And then when we went to full committee, we weren't allowed to talk again. We were not allowed to say another word. So this bill zoomed through the House of Delegates. I think we were able to get 17 or 18 no votes, and we did kill it in the Senate. But there's something wrong with that process that stifles facts before votes are taken. There is just something wrong. So that's my parting shot. So that's it. I'll be glad to answer any questions. So I hope I haven't offended you.
Let's take just a few minutes for questions and then move.
I think since we're a Dillon state, I don't think we should let memory retire until the state authorizes it.
There we go.
Or at least until she finds a replacement as capable and accomplished as she is.
Well, we're hoping. Indeed. Thank you.
Let's move on. We'll start with Delegate Tom Rust. And if not, Joe wants to go. Okay.
Sorry, the way I can keep an eye on my colleagues from Richmond. But Thank you, and let me just start off by saying we are going to miss Memory. She's slipped Tom, Russ, and I more notes on the House floor than our wives have. All in the line of business, I might add. By the way, I appreciate your comment regarding returning us to Richmond, although one of my kids had a little addendum to that situation. They said, talking about a bumper sticker, and they said, "Return Joe May to Richmond." And they suggested that we put, "They can't stand him in Leesburg." So, those are my kids. They love me. Well, good morning. And the group represented here is a group that's near and dear to my heart. Economic development has been one of the areas that I've tried to pay attention to and assist in the now 15 years that I've been, no, 14 years that I've been in Richmond. And I'll talk just a little bit about transportation, but I think I'll leave the majority of that to my seatmate here, Delegate Russ, since he and David Albo were the two major architects for the Northern Virginia transportation package. That doesn't mean that I wasn't involved in it, but Tom and David did really yeoman's work on that, and they deserve a great deal of credit for making it happen. I serve on two committees that have considerable relevance where economic development is concerned. First is I'm vice chair of the Transportation Committee, and believe me, the Transportation Committee has the opportunity to either assist or not assist economic development within the Commonwealth of Virginia. The other area is the Joint Commission on Technology and Science, because we're a technology policy-making body which meets in the off-season between sessions, and we consider topics which are appropriate, but basically they're about technology and science, and underlying that, of course, is the economic development aspects of it. Virginia's in an interesting situation. For 400 years, we've had an economy which was dominated by agriculture, by mining, by manufacturing, and probably in only the last 15 to 20 years has that economy shifted, or the emphasis in that economy shifted, toward the technology arena. And one really telling statistic here is that last year we exported more semiconductor devices in value than we did tobacco, and that's the first time in 400 years of Virginia's existence. That's good news, and it's bad news. The good news is technology is the major industry in Virginia. Bad news is that it takes a lot of adapting on our part in order to accommodate that business. During the session, of course, this year we looked at a number of things. Transportation was certainly one of them. And Memory mentioned taxes here regarding transportation. I see it from just a slightly different perspective, and the perspective is this. If you're a business person here in Northern Virginia, or for that matter anywhere in Virginia, transportation becomes as much a utility as does heat, light, rent, water, and sewer. Most business owners expect to pay for those utilities, and frankly, we're going to have to change our thinking to treat transportation as a utility which has to be paid for. Now, I own business down on Route 28. We're 30 years old as of January 1st. We've been there 29 years in that same location. Believe me, we wouldn't be there if the Route 28 special tax district had not been imposed in order to improve Route 28. If I can't get my employees to work, if I can't get my customers to see me, and equally bad, if I can't get my product out of there, I don't have a business. And when the Route 28 Special Tax District was imposed to improve Route 28, or keep it improved, or at least competitive, I complained like the rest of them. I wasn't in the General Assembly then, so I forego my right to complain. But the reality of the situation is we wouldn't be there, and we wouldn't be succeeding without it. And what the Northern Virginia Transportation Package does is make that so for other businesses and people in general in Northern Virginia. I'll leave it at that because Tom has much more interesting things to say about it. He's got the scars to prove it. One of the things that we're looking at in the General Assembly, in the Joint Commission on Technology and Science, is deployment of broadband in the underserved areas of the Commonwealth. Few things have the potential to assist the growth, economic growth of Virginia, particularly in the, again, in the underserved areas. When I say underserved, I'm not talking about just rural. I'm talking about almost anywhere that isn't adjacent to a major telecommunications facility. I have a good example. I live just south of town, and no more than a year ago, I was connecting at 6 to 12K connective rate, and that's it. If I wanted to download something, I'd go ahead and request it, and I'd go in and brush my teeth and come back, and it ought to be ready to go by the time I got back there. You can't conduct business from home that way. And telecommuting and businesses which are not in municipal areas cannot survive without good broadband service. Now, it turns out that it looks like wireless broadband is the only real game in town, and we're working very hard to come up with a template to get broadband wireless telecommunications to the underserved areas. And underserved is defined as anything that doesn't have at least DSL or better. But by the way, I live just south of town, literally a quarter of a mile outside the town limits. I had fiber optic running right past our road, but it might as well have been on the backside of the moon as far as accessibility was concerned. Cable, well, for $12,000, I'll bring you a cable right on across the ridge and connect you and your neighbors up. Each one is $12,000, a non-starter. Satellite, well, pretty good downloading, not so good uploading, because you basically have to go out by telephone. So we think broadband is about the only solution, wireless is about the only solution that's going to be available to us for the next decade or two, and we're moving very rapidly and very hard to come up with a template for how we might organize such an operation in various areas. Enough about broadband, but I cannot overemphasize how important that is if we are to adapt to the life that we have right now, particularly with regard to transportation and particularly with regard to entrepreneurship, not necessarily at the centralized level. Let's talk about power lines a little bit. Nobody here depends any more on electricity than I do for both my livelihood and frankly my personal comfort. So I definitely agree that we need electricity. And by the way, we have three transmission lines coming in Loudoun County probably within the next 5 years. Those big overhead transmission line towers are not an economic development attribute. Certainly the electricity is, but the appearance and the intrusion of those lines is not. We believe that ultimately we are going to find a way to put them underground. And the reason is even in question is this. The overhead transmission lines are costed at only the cost of the towers and the wires and the land which extends immediately underneath them. And nobody takes into account the fact that the towers encroach or deteriorate the value of the surrounding property. We got a bill out of committee and onto the House floor this year which would have allowed that to be taken into account when the utilities were taking the right-of-way for the transmission lines. And again, I'm not anti-transmission line. I just would like to have it with minimum intrusion and at a reasonable cost. The underground is typically quoted to be 6 to 10 times more expensive than overhead, but it's only so because the underground power line proposals are created by firms who believe that the utilities want a very high price to do this, and they certainly oblige them. So, well, they do. I'll give you a good example. They require 4 foot by 4 foot by 8 foot long concrete vaults to splice the cables in, and those are costed $22,000 each. I talked to one of the engineers about it, and I said, that thing looks remarkably like my septic tank, and I just had it replaced, and it was only $1,700 or $1,800. Why the $22,000? Is it, you know, stainless steel? Is it reinforced with titanium? Is it ultra high strength concrete? He said, no, that's just what they cost. So we think there's some room to be had in the costing of the individual components. This is an enormous task, by the way, to change how we approach this, because we've been doing it this way for 70 years. Ever since REA came through and built transmission lines back in the 30s, we've been doing it that way. It's one of the things I like about Virginia, by the way. We never rush into things. But I think we're going to be able to change that, and I appreciate all the help that I can get from any of the people in here, because several of us, in fact, Tom and I are part of the committee that is studying, will come up with legislative recommendations for underground transmission lines. Alternate energy is one of those business opportunities that is finally surfacing here in Virginia. I was frankly amazed, but it turns out that there are some alternative energy sources which are cost competitive as well as being environmentally friendly. I have to be honest and tell you that I often thought that alternative energy industry was basically attractive because you could harvest the incentives, and it turns out it's not working out that way. It turns out wind is cost competitive with fossil fuel right now. You can generate a kilowatt hour of wind power for less money, actually a little less money than you can with fossil fuels, and that's pretty remarkable. And we have a lot of opportunities here in Virginia. Biodiesel is one of those things. Basically, we're advocating the use of soybeans because you get the oil from it, it makes very high grade, low emissions diesel fuel, and you still get to keep the protein, which when I was a kid, we always fed to our cattle because they were nice and plump. So you get your protein on one hand, get your biodiesel on the other. I just choose those two. One of the other alternative energy areas, and it's going to take a little longer to develop, is the biomass area. I don't know if you've ever heard of switchgrass or not. It's simply a plant which grows voraciously, can be turned into alcohol for motor fuel. And that's come along really pretty well. It's a very mature business in Brazil, where they convert biomass into ethanol. So another of the areas. One of the economic development areas that I've been involved in for now nearly 10 years, but it's accelerated more recently, is the opportunities that exist in Southside and Southwest Virginia. Here in Northern Virginia, our unemployment rate is so low that, quite frankly, we have full employment and then some. If you can get up in the morning, you actually have your choice of the number of high-paying jobs. So that's not so in Southside and Southwest Virginia. And particularly with the advent of the internet, I just use that as a generic term, it's quite possible to take some of the business that is conducted here and do it in some other part of the state where one, unemployment is relatively high, and where there is a ready-made group of people who are willing to work on it. And one of the things that we did have done right in the General Assembly is that we have supported the community colleges and the technology schools. And one of the keys to moving any technology job to another part of Virginia is to make sure that you have facilities for training the folks who are there. They're willing to work, they just haven't been trained to do it. I opened a facility in Danville a year and a half ago, and the Danville Community College collaborated with us that actually established a number of training courses to teach them how to program, to operate, to make use of the automated machines that we use in our business. I'm an electronic engineering and manufacturing firm. We got 102 people there. These people are truly excited about it, and I'm excited about having employees that are that anxious to work. The only downside is that you do have a culture change to address. Most of the folks have worked in union circumstances for all of their career, and 9 o'clock means that you should be sitting by your coffee cup, and 9:15 means you should be back at your desk or at your bench. And this takes a little while because the technology business is not quite that way. In any event, there are opportunities to be had there. I'll mention one last thing, and that is the electrical re-regulation legislation that we looked at this year. And that's pretty important for economic development, because without electricity, a great number of you here would not have the businesses that you have. Certainly that's true in my own case. We had allowed the price of electricity to rise, quote, according to market demands. And unfortunately, it turns out there isn't really any competition. So we've chosen to go back into a semi-regulated arrangement. The way things stood, we were about to see some very large increases on year to year. In fact, as much as 25% increase in electricity prices. The re-regulation bill that we adopted has some fairly sturdy increases in them, but at least they're measured over a period of time, and they won't hit cold turkey as they would have otherwise. There just really is not a good answer for that one, and I agonized a lot over whether or not to support the re-regulation bill as written or not. And believe me, economic development with overpriced electricity becomes one of life's tougher endeavors if you use a lot of electricity. I point out a data center just as a for instance. In any event, the General Assembly is a lot like going to the circus. If you don't like this act, you can look over here, there's another, over here's another, and it's constantly changing. Must admit that it's one of the more satisfying activities I've ever engaged in, and simultaneously one of the most frustrating I've ever been engaged in. I'm basically a scientist at heart, and sometimes the logic of it just ruins me. But by and large, I've enjoyed it a great deal. I must say I've enjoyed working with these two folks here in memory. We're going to miss you.
Thanks.
And I never always agreed with you.
I know that, too.
Be happy to take questions if you have any. Otherwise, I'll declare victory and desert the field.
Well, we might move on in the interest of time and hear from Delegate Rust. I did want to mention both these gentlemen are major business owners, and we are, again, delighted to have you.
Well, thank you very much, and I am going to be intentionally brief. Memory has given you a good overview, and Joe, as always, has done a good job on talking about the major issues. I also want to thank Memory for keeping me straight the last 6 years and coming in and telling me how often I'm wrong. She brings a great deal of humility to me down there. And Joe May, you don't know how fortunate you are to have Joe there. Joe is a real leader on all the technology issues. He's out front on this broadband / wireless, and you will see the results of that, in my opinion. And he has been tireless in the General Assembly on attempting to get Dominion and others to put these overhead transmission lines underground. And I think you will see the benefit of the fruits of those labors. He has really been out front on that. He took on a really tough issue this year, and that is economic, I'm not sure that's the right term, but the economic degradation of adjoining properties when these things go through. And I didn't know Dominion had that many lobbyists in Richmond. But anyway, it's a pleasure to be there. Joe and I are the only two professional engineers in the General Assembly. We are a powerful caucus. He is the chairman of that group, and I am the vice chairman of that group.
We now have four engineers.
We have four engineers. We're the only two PEs, I think. Memory went through so much, and I tried to make a couple of notes, but let me just tell you what's going on in Northern Virginia about the change in power. I've only been there 6 years. The 6 years that I've been there, we have lost from Northern Virginia the chairman of transportation. We are losing the chairman of appropriations. We have lost the chairman of finance, and we have lost the chairman of the education committee. All of those were held by Northern Virginians. They are no longer held by Northern Virginians, and I suspect will not be held by Northern Virginians when we go back in January. So that's a problem up here to the whole area. It's a problem too that so many of us change over so often that we don't build the seniority, which is really critical to these things. The Dillon Rule, I want to touch on that very quickly. I come from local government. I spent over 25 years in local government, and so I know the frustrations of the Dillon Rule, and I think I'm right in this, Ed, that 2 years ago or something like that, we had to pass a bill in the Virginia General Assembly to allow Loudoun County to put American flags on the school buses. I mean, you know, that just doesn't make a lot of sense.
2 years before that, they had to pass a bill to allow us to paint the roofs white.
There you go. There you go. So that gives you some example of what's going on. And I'll touch on that very, very quickly. And Memory mentioned I was at a VACO meeting a couple weeks ago. I really think, and this is going to take a long time, but the whole structure of the relationship between the state and local government needs to be looked at. I mean, when this thing was put into effect, you didn't have a Fairfax County of the size it does. You didn't have a Loudoun County of this size, this sophistication. I mean, 40 years ago, you really didn't have it. I mean, you've got these counties up here that are really cities in every sense of the way, and the way we look at government, I think absolutely has to be done. It will take a number of years for that to occur, but I do think eventually that will occur and you'll see a major major change in the Dillon Rule. I still think the state will maintain a lot of powers. We don't want, and I'll say this as a local government guy, we don't want all this patchwork of rules and regulations all over the Commonwealth, because I think that's one of the things that we do have the Dillon Rule that makes us so successfully in attracting business and so forth. But I do think you're going to see some substantial changes. A couple of other things I'll just comment on. People say, well, why in the world can't you get something done? I mean, we need this, whatever the issue is in Northern Virginia, this is really a very, very, very different state. You get down into where Joe has now employed 102 people, and there are no jobs down there, folks. Just in a very short period of time, the textile industry has gone away, the tobacco industry is going away, the furniture business is gone away. Thousands and thousands of people in Virginia do not have jobs. So that's one of the reasons we have such a difficult time in getting things like the transportation bill through is you go down into those areas and their delegates and their senators are simply saying, we don't have these kind of problems. We are not going to tax our people for that. And that's one of the reasons you saw the Northern Virginia plan and the Hampton Roads plan and a reasonably modest plan statewide. You have to keep in mind that this is a very, very different state, and it's becoming, unfortunately, a state of the haves and have-nots. I saw something the other day that if you pull Northern Virginia out of the Commonwealth of Virginia and Hampton Roads, we would be one of the poorest states in the United States. We would be one of the poorest states in this entire country if you pull those two areas out. So it's very easy for us to be critical of our colleagues from other parts of the state, but believe me, they are representing their constituents in many, many ways. I do want to take a couple of minutes on transportation, and it's only going to be a couple of minutes. This was a huge, huge, huge battle. Is it a perfect bill? No. Is it the best in the world? No. Does it raise enough money that the problem is solved forever? No. Is a huge first step. The governor's office called me yesterday morning and said, have you seen the local papers? And I said something to the effect, no. I said, I did see the Washington Post, where the veto session, the dominant articles in the Washington Post were the overriding of the governor's vetoes of the death penalty, the defeat of the governor's smoking ban in restaurants, and then down the last paragraph, oh, by the way, they passed the largest transportation bill in the history of Virginia. Now, that makes no sense when it's literally headlines in every other newspaper in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Very frustrating. I cannot tell you how many people worked so hard on the transportation bill. Joe May and I, Dave Albo, Michelle McQuigg, Jean Marie Devilites Davis, Bill Mims. This is the first meeting. First meeting was held in my office in December of 05. We put a bill in the 06 session, got killed, just got killed. The only thing that came out of it was a commitment from the leadership to have a special session. We put another bill in, dramatically different, and I won't go through all the things that we went through. We went in front of the Finance Committee, and memory talks about how things go to various and sundry committees. We testified, and Dave Albo did yeoman's work. We testified in front of, and Joe and I were there, of course, testified in front of the Finance Committee, did not get a single Republican vote, and only about half the Democratic votes. So the bill was killed in September. We said, we're coming back. Somewhere between September of 06 and January of 07, something happened. In 07, we put the bill in, and I keep saying we. It was the Northern Virginia portion, Hampton Roads had a portion, and there really wasn't a statewide portion at that point. We filed the bills. The Speaker of the House of Delegates, who had been very much opposed to, I mean, realistically, had been very much opposed to doing anything to raise new money, put those two bills together, put a statewide component on it, and became the chief patron of the bill. The Speaker deserves an awful lot of credit, and while Joe and I took beatings up here from people who didn't think we needed any money, the Speaker took equal beatings from his constituency that he had, quote-unquote, change courses on, so to speak. So the Speaker of the House Delegates deserves an awful lot of credit. Lots of back and forth. Eventually the bill came out, went up to the governor. There were a lot of problems with it. Local governments had a lot of concerns with it. Give a lot of credit to Governor Kane. He went around the state, he listened to everybody, put all these amendments on the bill, and Wednesday, there was one speaker on the Republican side who stood up, actually the majority leader, and talked about the bill, the good things in it. One speaker on the Democratic side, the minority leader, stood up and made some nice comments about the bill. Then one or two or three, I've forgotten which, people stood up and just ripped the bill apart and said it was the worst thing that had ever happened. Came out of the House of Delegates 85-15. Went over to the Senate, passed over there 29-10, I believe. This is a major, major step forward. Raises over $3 billion statewide. If it's all implemented, over $400 million in Northern Virginia, about $200 million down in Hampton Roads. There are all kinds of protections in there that the money is raised here, it stays here. We do not get any diminution of the existing funds that are coming to us. It's a pretty good bill. local governments have stepped up. They've been extremely helpful, and if you believe what was in the Post this morning, I think this thing's going to get adopted. It's going to get adopted reasonably quickly. It does have a date that they have to act on by December of 07, I believe. And I was at a meeting last night where most of the local governments were there, and they were all talking very positively how they were going to move forward with it. I think it's not perfect. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it is a huge, huge step forward. It is the first major transportation infusion of money since 1986, and it's the largest we've ever done. The business community, we spent an awful lot of time, Vivian and Jeff, Vivian Watts, Delegate Vivian Watts, Albo, May, Rust, and Jim Scott and others, going to the business community saying, you're talking about transportation, we need your help. And the business community stood up, they stood tall. Most of the money originally was coming out of their pockets. Most of it is still coming out of the business community's pockets. The business community was an absolute key to this thing getting passed. The governor is quoted in the paper as saying that this is probably what he's going to do for transportation in his next couple of days. He's got 2 years left, if I recall. So it'll be some time before we see this again, but it will come back. It's been a pleasure working on it. I'll tell you a story a little like Joe did. Joe put a business in Danville, Virginia, so he could get people. I have a fairly large engineering firm that has offices in a number of states. I set up an office in Pennsylvania. I set an office up in Pennsylvania because I could not recruit people to come to Northern Virginia for a couple of reasons, not just transportation, but that was one of them, and price of housing. So I now have an office in Pennsylvania that we literally don't even have a sign up there because we don't want any more work up there. We're shipping work rather than sending it offshore. We're sending it to another state to get it done because we're between a couple of colleges. People want to live there. They want to work there. We're able to recruit. That's how serious the problem got. Thank you for having me, and Joe and I, in memory, are happy to answer any questions, and I've gone on much longer than I intended to. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we really appreciate just a wealth of information that you've provided. I'm going to move us along because we have a couple other issues. Normally we would take the time for questions, and maybe if folks have pressing issues, we can stay a little bit after. Before we leave this portion, we just want to provide memory with a little token of our appreciation for all your work. We have this lovely Loudoun County cup of coffee coaster for you. It's got a little on the back and some flowers and a cup of coffee to go with your coaster. And one for Delegate Danny. Thank you very, very much. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your leadership and for getting things done down there in Richmond. I think we all have a much better appreciation this morning for how hard it is that you work. And we thought 8 o'clock was an early morning meeting, but now we know you all are working harder than we are. So. Thank you. And before we leave the legislative portion of our agenda, I wanted to recognize we do have a couple other elected officials with us. Mayor Walker is here this morning from Lovettsville. Thank you. I saw Councilman Kelly Burke. Is she still here? Okay. Well, she was here to listen. So thank you all again for coming. We're going to move to the Open Skies Resolution, and I've asked Carol Welty to give us just a very quick kind of rundown of where this comes from, and Jim, you may want to chime in as well. This is an opportunity for us to voice our support for something that I think is more or less happening, but it's an opportunity for us to say that we believe. So,
right.
Carol.
Thank you very much. I put forward and asked Tamar if we could get the Loudoun County Economic Development Commission to basically put their support behind a US-EU you Open Skies Agreement. International air service is one of the most restrictive forms of international commerce. And currently, there are 20, with the EU, there are 27 different bilateral agreements with the United States that govern which airlines, which country's airlines can fly to America and vice versa. Open Skies would lift that and replace those 27 bilateral agreements with one, and basically allow market demand instead of government protocol or whatever to dictate international air service between the EU and the United States. 10 years ago, we worked really hard on getting Open Skies with Canada, and it's been an outstanding success. The reason, it was actually ratified on the 22nd of March, so I did want to add two changes to the resolution as proposed. The fifth whereas, the new agreement, if ratified, we can delete if ratified because it has been. The next step would be for the President of the United States and the President of the EU to sign the agreement at a summit that they're going to have on April 30th. The slight fear, but it still could be a fear, is congressional meddling. And it's happened before in 05. They basically, because of the divide port issue and there were foreign ownership issues in the agreement, they mixed it. So we just want to go on record. So should it come in front of the Northern Virginia congressional delegation, we want to go on record as supporting this. Already it means something for Dulles. Aer Lingus has announced its intention to start service to Dulles under this new agreement. And when you expand international air service, you expand trade and commerce, tourism between them. The last change I would have is that the very last, therefore, be it resolved, at the end it says implementation next October. They did change that to March. And that was to accommodate Heathrow having expanded their airport so that they could handle the increase. So
March 08.
Yes. So I would just like to make a motion, if I could, for the EDC to approve this and to send it to members of the Northern Virginia Congressional Delegation.
Second.
Is there any further discussion? Jim, any comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we'll make those changes.
Okay.
March 8th, be it ratified. Did you have a third? Just those two.
Right, just two.
Okay. All right, we're going to move quickly now to the Housing Advisory Board update. As you'll recall, we were here in September, the Housing Board, to provide you with a little bit of background as to what we've been doing. The Housing Board was created as a consequence of a series of recommendations that this group made to the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors to address that second issue that you raised, Delegate Rust, the need for affordable housing in our county. And Kim was with us. Kim's a member of the Housing Advisory Board. He was with us electronically last time, and I'm very glad that he could be here with us in person today. I also want to recognize Sarah Coyle Etro. Sarah, if you could stand up. She is Loudoun County's Housing Policy Manager. She's been the key liaison to our board. She's worked tirelessly on these issues, and we really appreciate your efforts and your willingness to be here this morning. In case there were questions that Kim and I couldn't handle, we give all the tough ones to Sarah. So, and I don't know if there are other Housing Advisory Board members here. I don't believe that Kim and I both serve. I did want to recognize Joe Pacciulli, who is the chairman of the Affordable Dwelling Unit Advisory Board. We've been working very closely together, and you'll see some of that in the presentation today. So under Joe's leadership, I think we've really moved this issue forward. And with that, I'll turn it to Kim, and you'll
expeditiously
keep the pace.
Good morning. As you know, Tamar and I both are your representatives on the Housing Advisory Board, although Tamar was recently elected chair of that board, so whatever efficiency you've seen to date here is about to get redoubled. So we'll try and meet our taskmaster. Very quickly today, I'm just going to touch on who the players are so you know the faces. Just a quick update on what's happened over the last few months, where we stand now. address what this definition of called unmet housing needs is, and talk about the recommendations that have recently gone to the Board of Supervisors, and then a quick update on next steps. These are the players, sort of in order of their age. The Industrial Development Authority is there because they have the ability in a jurisdiction like ours that doesn't have a housing authority to act as a housing authority. Betsy Self is the representative that comes to all of our meetings. John Harris, as you know from this group, is also on the IDA, and Brian Chavez is a new member of the IDA. So the EDC is well represented in that regard. The Affordable Dwelling Unit Advisory Board, that group has been around about 12 years now, Joe. And if you just recall, any subdivision in the county that's over 50 units and it's on public water and sewer has to provide at least 12.5% affordable dwelling unit of affordable units, which is for those who earn 30 to 70% of the area median income. After ramping up the speed, that's up to about 200 units a year now, Joe. Yeah, 200, yeah, that, which is not bad. The Housing Advisory Board is the newest on the map. We were only about, 18 months old now? And our mandate is to be a little broader, to address housing at a little bit at a lower scale, below the 30% where ADU doesn't go, and also a little higher, beyond 70%, up to what we've defined as 100% of area median income. Those three groups have all decided to work as a joint committee, and that's the representation, to try and get all the various little pots of money that are available for housing in the county into one pot so it can be administered out of one pot to just ease the whole process of doing that. Okay, unmet housing needs. This has been a definition we've been trying to work out over the last few months. And basically the goal is to try and come up with a definition that doesn't have a lot of baggage with it. Affordable housing, as you know, is a word that now has some baggage with it. Some people hear affordable housing and they mean those are the people that we don't want to live next door. So, but we do have a real disproportionate number of workers coming in from outside the country, outside of the county. Shortages of housing are really most severe at the lowest end of the spectrum, where the market doesn't work very well. There are in the county now, as it says here, about 52,000 households that are above 100% AMI. That means that there are also about that many below. So we're looking on a base in the county of about 100,000 homes. So keep that in mind as we go forward. And if we don't do something about this, it's not going to go away, it's just going to get worse. Here's what I was saying. The comp plan means the county comprehensive plan, which is the document that drives housing policy, and it also drives all the related land use policies that you need if you're going to deal with housing. It currently has two sections, or two definitions: special needs housing, which is under 30% of area median income. Area median income is for a family of four, $90,300. So that's one of the ways you know we are one of the richest counties in not only Virginia, but also the entire United States. It also defines affordable as that 30 to 70% of AMI, and there is specific Loudoun County legislation that is a result of that on all the new developments. Where we're going is to propose in a new definition be put into the comp plan, which addresses unmet housing needs, which is to basically talk about the housing that we need to house the workers that are working here but can't live here, and basically subdivide our target market into three segments: the 0 to 30, 30 to 70, 70 to 100, but without the labels. There was a discussion over the last few months about whether there should be a thing called workforce housing, and that should be for those that were from the 70% of AMI up to as high as 125% of AMI. That would be the workforce housing. Does that mean that workforce housing is good and affordable housing is bad, and that there are no workers that earn less than 30% of AMI or 70% of AMI? And we just try to wash away that whole discussion and just say we're trying to address the whole unmet housing need for our workers in these three various segments. As I said before, it is a continuum. We decided that the continuum did need to expand up to 100% of area median income. 70% wasn't high enough because it was leaving out a lot of the teachers and other public workers that we're trying to serve by this discussion of the need for workforce housing. What you do in each of these segments is different. At the lowest segment, the 0 to 30% of area median income, that's where you need to have the most public money, and you have to have the most leverage on that public money because the market just can't work there in this environment. So the public money really has to come to the table to make things happen there. 30 to 70, as you know, we have the very good ADU legislation, but there's much more that can be done in that segment. And then we're adding this new 70 to 100% segment, which takes less direct money, but takes more sort of policy involvement to help make that work. This slide, excuse me, I need a drink of water.
And folks, if you haven't discovered it already, you do have the presentation at your desks, a hard copy.
This one slide is a summary of most of a year's worth of work. It started with our commissioning ACOM to do a study of housing in the county. It was done under these segments as we define them. And what you see here is the snapshot for 2005, the number of households that we currently have in each of these categories, and how short we are if we were going to house our workers in about the same proportion as 30 other counties that we looked at as a sort of benchmarking exercise. That's 24,000 units short on about 100,000 that we have now. Is that exactly the right number? No, we don't know that it's exactly the right number, but it's the right order of magnitude. So that's what we're going out to try and do something about. If we don't do anything, that number gets considerably worse by 2030. The study goes out that far. Okay, so the first step was to look at the county's housing policy. Current policy was adopted in July 2001. There are some significant changes that are needed, and we spent several months in the Housing Advisory Board going through that policy piece by piece, and it was decided that we needed a new comprehensive plan amendment. That's what the CPAM means. Just roughly, the policy it has existed was out of date. It currently has 23 policies. It's a long list. It doesn't look forward very well. We've actually made it worse by coming up with 32 policies, but at least we organized it better, and it does have some better detail in it. Sort of general principles that residents and those who work here, who would like to live here, should be given a wide range of housing opportunities. As you know now, many of them have no opportunity at all. That housing is key to the health of the community. Dr. Hetrick speaks eloquently on that point. We know that the market can't do it, and that programs are required to address these if we're going to have the right prices that we need. These are some of the things we added. Things like universal design and energy efficiency you'd think would be no-brainers, but they aren't there. So all of these are substantive items that had to be added. So as the result of our work over the last 18 months, we made 6 recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. Start a CPAM to get the housing policies updated. Consolidate the housing funds, about 6 or 7 of them in different little pots here and there, into one fund. One of them was the Belmont Ridge that needed supervisor work to actually get it rewritten so it can go into the pot. Approve one full-time person to help the housing department that we have here to begin to implement some of these programs. Replenish the $1 million that we were given in 05 but not in 06 or 07 in the 08 budget. And identify a long-term dedicated revenue source that we can put to this 24,000 housing problem that we have. The first 4 are basically process, and the last 2 are the money. I'm going to go through these very quickly in the interest of time. I already talked about why we needed the new update. These are the funds that we're consolidating. These are the 4 main funds and roughly the amount that is in each one. The largest one is the ADU fund, which has come out of the operation of the Affordable Dwelling Unit Program that Joe works on. A lot of that money comes from developers that choose to buy out rather than actually provide the units. There have been proffers over the years. Many of those proffers were before the ADU legislation, and we have a little bit of money left out of ours. Total pot of money at the moment is about $7 million. I'm talking about need to consolidate the funds. To what purpose? All the things you'd want in a good housing program: retention, creation of new rental units and for sale units, rehabilitation, homeownership programs, land banking, community infrastructure, and then doing what you can to jigger with the development formula to try and make more happen. Just a paperwork detail, the staff person we need. As I said, the $1 million that we got in 05 has not happened in 06 or 07. So that was one of our main recommendations. That was supported by the Board of Supervisors Human Services Committee and went before the board. And let me not forget, since transportation was sort of the theme of the hour, housing certainly relates to transportation. If they could live here, they wouldn't all have to drive here quite as much as they do. And finally, and most importantly, to identify a long-term funding source to address this problem. We mean a local funding source. Every time I get up here, you hear me preach it, but the Department of Housing and Urban Development, except for the Community Development Block Grant Program, is sort of missing in action here. Vouchers are no longer coming to our county. In 5 years, we've gotten one new voucher. The program has actually diminished from what it was 5 years ago. HUD is not going to solve this problem for us. We're going to have to do it ourselves. So let's just get on with that. How are we going to get to 24,000 units? That's the question. We have to have a committed revenue stream. I'll come back to that at the end. We sent forward 6 recommendations as of Tuesday. We got the first 4, which were all of the process, and we're now ready to go forward and do that. We didn't get any of the money. Memory's probably not surprised at this process, how this process works. But at least we're getting organized, and this is where the EDC has to continue to step up to the table. We simply have to get some funding in place to make this work. My last slide, what are the next steps? For the Housing Advisory Board, these are sort of our immediate items of work, which are to get the CPAM supported. That is a public process, requires a lot of public input. We need to be on top of that process. We need to start writing the programs. Even with the $7 million we have in hand, we can begin to get that money out the door to start doing the leveraging we like. We need to get that specific programs in place. There are 2 or 3 in place at the moment, but not nearly enough. And we need to help the county staff get up to speed in doing that. But of course, what can the EDC do? And the answer is, you have to continue to support the Housing Advisory Board and the whole issue in general, because without you, the Housing Advisory Board wouldn't even exist. Second of all, when the CPAM comes forward, we would like to come to many of you and ask you to testify. It's a reasonably painless process. Coaching can be provided, but it is important, just as you heard this morning in Richmond, the business community does have to step up here. Support a dedicated and local source of revenue. I was hoping that Al Smuzminski was going to be here today, who's Wesley Housing, who is in the area and is the real guru on all of this. And he was going to tell the tale, which I will simply summarize by saying Fairfax has the penny for housing put forward in their tax base now. That's this year going to bring forward $21 million. Alexandria, Arlington has their penny, and that's $3.5 million. But they have leveraged that by doing a bond based on that income stream. Our neighbors are attacking this problem with their dedicated funding source, and they're having a real impact. So we just need to catch up. And then finally, over the next year and two, as employers, you're going to be able to start participating in some of these programs that we're going to bring forward. That's it.
Thank you. We went through it very quickly, hoping to have time for questions.
Jim, can we not leverage that $7.2 million we have in the pot to some degree and get it started? $7.2 sounds low, but on a leverage basis, it's pretty high.
Yeah, if you just went out and bought houses that you would have at a low cost, maybe $100,000 a unit, you know, that gets you 72 units. That's not going very far. Joe is part of the Windy Hill Foundation, and we're doing a 20-unit project in Middleburg now. We started that with a $300,000 bump from the CDBG program, the Community Development Block Grant Program. So that was the first dollar that was necessary to start the process. On top of that, we got money from the Federal Home Loan Bank, we got local contributions, and with all of that in our pocket, we then went to the Virginia Housing Development Authority, VHDA, and we're going to get some low-income housing tax credits. All of that together is going to be about a $3.5 million project, but it all became possible because of the $300,000 that was kicked in at the bottom that made it happen. That was about a 10-to-1 ratio leverage. That would get us up to, what, 720 units if we could make that happen all the way across the board, but that's still only 3% of the problem. So I think the answer is, you know, we need to be in the Fairfax range of getting up to $7, $8, $9, $10 million a year if we're going to really get anywhere on this whole problem.
But it does get you started.
Absolutely.
Yeah, John.
How do businesses find out more about this besides, you know, Dr. Hattrick with he's got the same problem I have, okay, with the $40,000 a year. So I'm down to the 30% bracket. So who do we go to from a business standpoint with issues like that? Unless I have all my people move out to West Virginia and do like Tom did, move out to Pennsylvania.
Well, I think the answer is that we simply have to get the basic money in place that we can leverage to start getting the units built. The ADU legislation is good. It's I think if we were to ask some of the developers, they would view it as a stick. You know, it's just they have to do that to do business here. Some actually do it, others avoid it and just buy out of the program. Joe may want to speak to that point. But I think we also need to have incentives so that we can, you know, encourage the development community to come and build units in this range. And that's going to take some public funding at that lower end of the scale to make that happen.
And John, if you're asking how do employers find out about the available resources that their employees might avail themselves of in order to be able to afford a house, there's a project underway. We're coordinating with Leadership Loudoun, they're going to be doing a website that's going to put a lot of the current programs and then, of course, the future programs that Kim's been talking about, information about how to access those is going to be on the web. And then this new FTE that we've just gotten approval for is also going to be working on the public education. There are a number of housing programs currently. They've been reorganized into the Department of Family Services. It used to be under one umbrella, and now it's been kind of dispersed. But Sarah's been working very hard to bring everybody together to make sure we have on one sheet the information about what's currently available. And Sarah,
you ought to stand up so that you can be recognized, and then also you might want to answer the question.
Well, no, I would just say exactly the identifying the need for the resource we kind of refer to as the marketing person. We recognize and talk to individual businesses, and even on the programs that we have that are existing, there's not good understanding or a go-to. That's one reason we identified that FTE, and as we, for example, just recently, the county has allocated $2.5 million from VHDA. We had to get organized fast to get the word out so that it's for people who earn up to $108,000 a year in household income, for loans up to, for housing up to $415,000. So it starts addressing higher level of income, which is the key issue. How do we make people know about it? There's been, you might have heard recently, there have been press releases, there's information on the radio, put it on the website, that kind of thing. We need to be better organized, and also create a liaison with the business community to talk to you, the individual employer, about what your need is and what information you need to bring. That's part of the strategy of the works.
Dr. Henry.
It strikes me that there may be two problems we need to work on as well, or maybe three. One is the ability of a developer to buy out of the program. So I'm not sure what happens to the money when they buy out of the program, whether it then benefits some sort of affordable dwelling unit or workforce housing, and maybe Sarah has an answer to that.
Well, part of the four funds that Kim had up on the slide had offers listed, and also had county allowed housing trust. That's where the money is. And part of this initiative is to start using the money.
Because right now we're not using
it. It's sitting in the trust fund.
That was my understanding. And the other thing is that with our current stance on development, wherever you are on that, you know, I don't know how many subdivisions are going to get approved that have more than 50 units. And if they don't have more than 50 units, they don't come under this in any case. And Joe was just commenting to me, sort of a sidebar conversation. I mean, to get employees now affordable housing, they have to go pretty deep into West Virginia. It's not just across the border anymore. And I wonder, just sat here and wondered, because I was in D.C. yesterday and saw a bunch of our Loudoun commuter buses coming down as we were coming out mid-afternoon. They were coming down to pick up. Have we given any thought to running workforce transportation into West Virginia and making it available to private and public sector employees?
We are looking into that, Ed. Talked about it at the staff level. We're exploring the possibilities of making that happen. Maybe a run out to, like Jefferson County, places like that, even up into Frederick County, Maryland, and Washington County, because I know we're pulling a lot of workers now from Western Maryland. So we are looking into that as a real possibility. We may have something to bring before the Board of Supervisors in the not too distant future. That was a very popular service, and when you raise that issue, even with county employees, they get pretty excited about it. So,
Last question. The phrase is drive till you qualify for the loan.
Ken, once you put the money to work and you need that funding source, would you prefer to have for a while the dollars in lieu of the ADU units, or is you got to have both? I mean,
Well, you have to have both. I mean, the ADU is a good program. But the question is, how do we prime the pump and really get the development community looking at how we're going to supply 24,000 houses or 20 or whatever the number is? You know, there's lots of policy discussions that have to be had. And it probably is going to fall to the next Board of Supervisors to have those. But, where is this funding going to come from, and how are we going to find a place to put the 24,000 houses? You've heard from Robin, her commercial square footage is not going to be easily given up to multifamily housing. So there are lots of policy discussions yet to go.
And one tricky piece of that, too, is that we have to remember for every market rate home that we build, we're going to need construction workers, local government, and retail workers to service that home. And those are three of the four industries that already disproportionately in commute. So we're going to be... We really, it's sort of a tricky dynamic there. We need to be very careful how we move forward. We have one more question.
I'm not understanding the basic difference between rental and for sale in the ADU program. Can you comment on the 24,000? What proportion do you see as rental versus for sale?
Oh, on the...
In the deficit?
Yeah, well, in the overall picture of moderate income housing,
right.
What proportion is going to be rental?
The chart of the numbers here pretty well addresses it. Under 30% of AMI, it's almost all going to be rental, or the vast majority of it. You just aren't going to get people into home ownership in this county at that income level. 30 to 70, where the ADU program is, and Joe can correct me if I'm wrong, they do get rentals for the lower end of that scale, but the home ownership program is really in the 65 to 70% of AMI. And we really haven't worked in this area of 70 to 100% before the market. That's where the market really needs to have some bump. So the majority of the rentals are at the lower end of the scale.
Again, lots more we can say on this topic. Kim, I want to thank you for a great job today. And we're gonna move on very quickly. I want to point out you all have, is this buff? Is that what color this is? I don't know. Goldenrod, thank you. You have a goldenrod sheet at your desk, and this also came in the packet.
This is a survey that the executive committee wanted to do. We're looking for two things. We're looking for your views on whether we're addressing the salient issues and help us prioritize and let us know how we're doing as an organization. I really like to get 100% return on this survey, and I was going to actually make you sit here and take it and not leave the room. But since we're low on time, you get a pass. I'm taking a leap of faith. Please, though, please get this done. It's only going to take you 5 minutes. We really want your input on this. There's some questions in the back that would take a little bit more thought. But again, 5-10 minutes on this will really help us in the EDC leadership here to figure out if we're going in the right direction. So please do your homework. We're going to go quickly to the committee updates. And I'll start with exec, since Deborah's not here. We had a very raucous meeting this last week. I don't know what was in the air. Mercury retrograde or whatever that was. But one of the ideas that we floated, and we haven't really given it any serious thought, but I wanted to raise it here in case people want to give it some thought and get back to us. We're wondering whether it might make sense for this body, the chamber, which we're going to be jointly meeting with the executive committee and the chamber board soon, perhaps the Convention Visitors Association, the REDC, and the HAB and AGWAB, whether it might make sense for these boards to try to come together and see if we can think about a broad vision for the county and what that would look like. Kind of an ambitious notion, but we are going to be this next year, I think in 08, looking at a revision of the comprehensive plan for the county. I don't know that the Board of Supervisors has fully put forward a unified vision. I thought it might be interesting to see and contemplate whether the advisory boards of this this county might be able to come together and at least in very broad strokes say this is the kind of county we want to be living in the future. So just something to think about. We'll move on to marketing and business retention.
Our monthly meeting to the first Tuesday of every month. So, if you all want to join us, we have changed our date. So, we actually have two meetings in between our last. But the main thing that we've been working on is the active meeting on May 3rd. We received to save the date. But if you all remember, so what the actual is going to look like. I'll pass them around. So we'll be receiving them here before the next meeting. And many of you all just stepped up to the plate and they're great to be sponsors. I sent an email yesterday to those of you who have a great to be sponsors, just as sort of a reminder to send your checks in
pay
to
up.
The 13th of April. So thank you all very much. And then the other thing that we're working and focusing on between now and the end. Sources of venture capital to bring into Loudoun County. Fairfax is very tapped into venture capital and angels. And it's just something we want to find out where they are for Loudoun County and we'll be reporting back over the next couple of months.
Right.
Aaron's going to be a meeting one here in April, so we'll come back.
So again, May 3rd, VIP reception. The next morning is our May meeting, which will
yes.
be here. Okay. Great. Policy and implementation, Sean.
We had a good meeting yesterday. We Cheryl today, the president of Loudoun County Visitors Authority, made a presentation of what they're doing. Specifically, we focused on the 5% tax on overnight accommodations, which is known as the transient occupancy tax, used to promote tourism travel, businesses that generate tourism travel. We reviewed their funding policies, their tourism destination strategy, including strategic tourism growth initiatives. We looked at their marketing strategies, their year-to-date budget versus their actual expenditures, and core tourism services that will perform in the upcoming year. We reviewed the visitors' already proposed services as they relate to our strategic plan, and that's something that's in their policies to have the EDC look at their
initiatives at least once a year to see if they dovetail nicely with our strategic plan. We concluded as a committee that that they're right on target, doing what they need to do, no changes needed. The committee also thought that Cheryl should make a presentation to the full EDC of May. It's making a lot of progress in their efforts, and they do provide the services to the community, and that they do help subsidize our property taxes a bit. We also had made further steps in our project to look at the commercial tax base. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, but we did have a start with Ben Mays and Bob Wertz to come in. We've asked them to come back next month to help us look at some of the history behind the commercial tax base, specifically focusing on the components of that that are in addition to just the traditional property tax that comes in. And I asked them to come by because looking at the fiscal impact survey that they do annually, I wanted to make sure that we weren't being redundant with our efforts as well, and so to kind of look at that survey and see how that can be used to help us with our project and impacting the impact.
Great.
Where we are.
Thank you. Ted, transportation infrastructure.
We met on March 15th, and we had Ken Hill come in from Dominion Power to give a presentation on the transportation, our transportation transmission lines. And it was a very very good presentation. I will say it's good to get some balance here because by the end of the presentation, you know, they're only going in the right of ways was the message. It's not really going to touch Loudoun, and if we don't do it, we're going to have brownouts every 15 minutes on the hour. It was very scary, and so I was ready to start the bulldozers right there. But I'm very interested in the underground options, and I think we need to dig in a little more to that. If we can figure what the best option is. We did talk a little bit about the rail to Dulles with the report coming out regarding the tunnel option. And then next meeting, we've got the hopefully George Phillips from the transportation Department of Transportation coming in to talk about the update of the countywide transportation plan.
Right. Wonderful. Nikki, do you want to give an update on
it? Yeah, very sure. And the marketing is working very hard on the website, which is what they're working on. And Rural Business did not have a meeting, and we're looking for two positions. So somebody has, somebody who will pitch be our council on business.
Great. Okay. Any particular business or industry? Or
you'd have to check with Andy because I don't know. I did not receive an email. I've been having trouble with my computer, so I have to check the animal.
Larry was very gracious in deferring his time, but I do want to hear a quick 30 seconds.
For those of you who didn't know, we've been working on rebranding or branding Loudoun over the last 18 months. You've got the first part. This is the beginning, not the end. It's, Churchill would say this is not the beginning of the end, this is the end of the beginning. So this is where we are. Take a look at our portfolio. You'll recognize 9 county stars as part of recognizing a different way to tell Loudoun's story. We'd love to get your feedback. You'll recognize a few of the people here. This is, by the way, not my photography, but a true professional that we're using out there. And you'll see in here we printed many thousands of these. We want to go through our first reprint as soon as possible. So we want to get them out. It's a different way to tell Loudoun's story by people relate to people. And we'll start to tell other stories. The snapshots in here, people wonder, well, how did you pick that person? Or why did you reflect that office? The answer is, those are sort of snapshots. It's a fall last year. And sort of that's where we are in terms of any different positions or things that people hold. So, and then we'll redo this in maybe a year, 18 months. We want to add to different things on our website. So more stories coming, but we hope you will use this as a way to give people a sense of our community. If you recall, part of our mission is to build a strong sense of community, and that's really all about the people. So if you know some of the stars, I'm sure they're willing to give autographs. And we will be passing these out to you, anyone else who would like to give them and be our ambassadors. As I said, lots more material coming.
Great. Well, we are meeting May 3rd at the, well, partying, excuse me, May 3rd at the VIP reception of Lansdowne, being here May 4th. Our June meeting is still to be determined. We have the option of the new rec center at Clonmore Park, where we can more or less squeeze in. It's hard to get a round table this big, but if people have other ideas for facilities, we're still open. We haven't locked that down. So we'll announce a final decision, of course, in June, and then obtain your packets and so forth. In May, and then we'll be at that new spot just for June and back here in August. Is there any other old or new business? Okay, then we are adjourned. And thanks again, Delegate May, and we thank you so much for coming.